I've always been and always will be an environmental maniac. Since I was in early elementary school, I've been an avid recycler. I have attempted to create minimum waste. I've planted numerous trees in my yard. I've run a garden. And I have attempted to coerce my dad into avoiding fertilizers and pesticides, among other things. Conservation has always been an important part of my life. When I was very young, I first learned about the laws of conservation, thinking that they were conservation laws, as in, like, environmental conservation laws. But that was definitely not true. Thinking that these laws dealt specifically with the environment, I became very interested in the laws of conservation. Unfortunately, my 7-year-old childish ignorance had the best of me, for the laws I stumbled upon dealt not with the environment, still somewhat does, but rather with physics. The moment was the first in my life in which I taught myself physics. I felt almost like Einstein, except I had a very rudimentary understanding of all the topics anyways, so I don't really know why I could consider myself Einstein, but yeah. As a testament to my 7-year-old self, this chapter is to be dedicated to the laws of conservation, what they are not, and their collective importance. We're specifically just going to be talking about the specific laws of conservation. I'll tell you this, I did not expect that it would be this bad. I did not expect that it would get this advanced, because we started talking about gauge symmetry, and when you get into gauge invariance, gauge symmetry, that's when it starts to get a little heavy, because that's when you're talking about non-abelian groups, you're talking about all the crazy Lie groups and the unitary groups, everything in group theory of abstract algebra, it just gets really, really heavy. So I did not expect it to be like this, but we're still going to do it. We're still getting into it, of course, because that's important. But anyways, a conservation law is a law in physics which details that a specific physical phenomenon does not change through time within an isolated system. Conservation laws apply to many realms of physics, specifically in the properties of matter and in particle physics, such as conservation of color charge, weak isospin, baryon and lepton numbers, strangeness, hypercharge, etc. And there are many types. There are many different conservation laws, first of all. From the top of my head, there's matter, energy, mass, lepton number, baryon number, probability. It's quantum probability, not like the laws of basic probability, momentum, angular and linear momentum, etc. But anyways, there are two types of conservation laws in physics. There are the exact laws and the approximate laws. Exact laws apply to all processes in nature and exist through symmetries in Noether's theorem, which states that every differentiable, figure out what differentiability is, symmetry of actions of a physical system with conservative forces, or a force whose work is determined not by the path of the object takes, the path the object it acts upon takes between two points, but rather only through an object's endpoint, has a corresponding conservation law. These symmetries hold invariances that create the exact conservation laws that dominate scientific advancement today, because we really follow the conservation laws by heart, because they are laws. So one thing that I think we should actually point out is that a theory can technically never become a law. From what I have researched, a theory can technically never become a law. A law describes that a process is occurring in nature. So there, the existence of evolution, for example, that is a law. That is a scientific law. It's an indisputable fact. But the mechanism behind evolution is a disputable fact. It is a theory. I mean, granted, a theory, it's such a good theory that at that point, it's such a great, incredible, and grand theory. At this point, it has such a wide body of evidence that there's really necessarily no need to say that it is a disputable fact, but of course there lie some discrepancies. We cannot deny those, even as evolution lovers or whatever. We can't really deny it. But that's the thing. Like, conservation laws are like, a law is undeniable. It represents something that occurs in nature. Like the law of gravity. We know that it exists. But the theory to gravity, we don't. We don't know the mechanism behind gravity at all. Even general relativity does not go as far to explain the quantum world of gravity. But anyways, approximate conservation laws, on the other hand, are different from exact conservation laws in that they don't necessarily apply to all situations. So approximate conservation laws are approximately true only in certain circumstances, such as specific speeds, timescales, or interactions. Some examples of approximate conservation laws include the conservation of mechanical energy, which is approximate because it only applies when no energy loss occurs as a result of friction. See the episode on thermodynamics. And then also the conservation of mass, which is approximate because the law does not apply to open systems in special relativity. Additional examples of approximate conservation laws include the conservation of baryon number, lepton number, flavor, quark and lepton flavor, parity invariances under charge conjugation and time reversal, and charge parity symmetry. We've spoken about a vast majority of these in the past. Flavor, we should know what flavor is. We should know what charge parity symmetry is. That's from quantum chromodynamics. I'd see that episode too. We have not done anything about charge conjugation and time reversal yet, but a majority of these we have done, so this shouldn't be anything necessarily new, per se. As is known, an exact conservation law is underlain by a symmetry that fosters its existence. We know that through the Nether's theorem. Some examples of exact conservation laws include mass energy equivalence, the law of conservation of momentum, electric charge, color charge, weak isospin, and probability, most of which I'm sure most of my readers and listeners, specifically my listeners in this, have heard of. Now, I'm pretty sure you haven't heard of law of conservation of probability, because when I first heard about it, I thought that it was probability, as in like 1/6 is 0.1 or 16.66666667% chance of something happening. So like a 1 in 6 chance. So rolling a 6, you have a 16.666666. Okay, you guys get it. But exactly, like that's what I was expecting, but actually it deals in the quantum world. And that's not ever necessarily a good thing. These laws underlay all events and phenomena that occur in the universe and are laws that govern all subsequent scientific advancements. We have to exist within these invariances. Within these conservations. The first conservation law that is to be communicated is mass energy equivalence. I'm sure you probably know exactly what I'm about to talk about. This particular mass energy equivalence gives rise to the most famous equation in human history, to be honest, E equals MC squared. That equation, of course, when based upon an object at rest, specifically pertaining to an object with mass, of course. The mass energy equivalence conservation law establishes that all objects with mass have a corresponding intrinsic energy even when at rest. So potential kinetic, you know that. In the case of an object at rest, the intrinsic energy would be potential energy, whereas in the case of an object in motion, the intrinsic energy would be kinetic energy. In terms of massless objects, like photons, their equivalence is not in mass energy equivalence, but rather in momentum energy equivalence, which is represented in the equation by E equals pc, p being a momentum and c being the speed of light. The mass energy equivalence is underlain by time translation invariance, a transformation that moves the times of events through a common interval, chronology. Time translation is closely related to mass energy equivalence through the Nether theorem, which we know is a law that establishes that any differentiable symmetry of actions in a system of conservative forces is accompanied by a corresponding conservative conservation law. Two particular conservation laws from the mass energy equivalence include the law of conservation of energy, which is another approximate law. It states that the total energy of a closed system always remains constant. This one is an exact conservation law. The law of conservation of energy exists everywhere in nature and has likely been elaborated upon in most contemporary middle school science classes. The law of conservation of energy is further established in the first law of thermodynamics, which is essentially energy conservation that adds in heat. Because, of course, the Greek root for heat is therm. Energy conservation is also an exact conservation law. Unlike mass conservation, energy conservation is universal and applies in all situations. Energy conservation is a law that is accompanied by a symmetry under Nether's theorem, whereas mass conservation is not accompanied with a particular invariance. The second is the law of conservation of mass, which states that mass must be conserved in any closed system that is closed to both mass and energy. While energy's conservation is an exact law, mass conservation is only an approximate law. For in certain relativistic situations, the conservation of mass is not applicable. An example of a moment at which mass conservation does not exist is in an open system in special relativity, whereas if the system is isolated or completely cut off from all interaction, it follows mass conservation. The next two exact conservation laws are the laws of conservation of linear momentum and angular momentum. Both conservation laws are underlain by separate symmetries, making them different conservation laws. Thus, they will be discussed separately, albeit under the same section in the episode section per se. The law of conservation of linear momentum, which is the first one we're going to discuss about, is conserved in an inertial frame, a frame of reference in which the current state of an object is unchanged. So think of how inertia is the state of remaining unchanged or unaltered. Now apply that to a frame of reference. If no force acts upon an object that has linear momentum, then the linear momentum of the object will be conserved. The law of conservation of linear momentum is governed by two invariances. Space translation invariance is the first one, and then also Poincaré invariance. I have a lisp, so cut me some slack. Space translation invariance is a translational symmetry, a symmetry that occurs as an invariance of a system of equations when subject to any translation. This particular invariance occurs in the three spatial dimensions, which we obviously represent in the Euclidean spaces x, y, and z axes, whereas the conservation of the mass energy equivalence occurs in the time dimension, or the time axis, which is just t. The second encompassing symmetry is the Poincaré invariance, which is a symmetry that occurs under the Poincaré group, a 10-dimensional non-abelian, or non-commutative, Lie group. And then, of course, a Lie group is a group in abstract algebra that is also a differentiable manifold, meaning that the group is similar enough to the linear space that it can be used to do calculus. Lie groups. That's abstract algebra. We're already at abstract algebra. But anyways, the Poincaré invariance, as it is 10-dimensional, implies, through Noether's theorem, 10 conservation laws. These 10 conservation laws occur 1 through the law for energy, 3 for momentum, 3 for angular momentum, and 3 for velocity of the center of mass. The law of conservation of angular momentum, on the other hand, is a conservation law that establishes the conservation of angular momentum in any closed system. As is likely known, angular momentum is the inertia of the rotational velocity of an object, which is expressed by the equation L equals mvr, with m being mass, v being velocity, and r being the radius. Angular momentum conservation exists through rotational symmetry, a spatial symmetry that operates through the three spatial dimensions. So collectively, the conservation of angular momentum is simply the conservation of angular momentum in an object in which no outside forces act upon the object. So just, this is pretty easy to imagine. The next law is the law of conservation of electric charge, which establishes the conservation of an electric charge in a closed system. The principle concludes that the total charge of a completely isolated system always remains constant, meaning that the net positive or negative charges in an isolated system, so like positive charges minus negative charges, are always conserved. Charge conservation also implies that the change in the amount of electric charge in any volume of space must be exactly equal to the gain in electric charge minus the loss in electric charge. The net changes refer specifically to the transfer of electric charge between volumes. For in a closed system, the net charge of the volume always, as in always, remains constant. Because again, it's an exact law. Electric charge conservation exists through a far more complicated symmetry than other symmetries that establish conservation laws. Not really, because once we get into the other symmetries, specifically the color charge symmetries, it makes these look pretty simple. The underlying symmetry is U1 unitary singlet or circle group gauge invariance. U1 gauge invariance is a particular gauge invariance in which the Lagrangian formalism, or a formal description of a mathematical phenomenon in classical field theory, is invariant under the U1 or the circle group. It's known as three different things. The U1 group is known as either U1, the unitary singlet, I like to call it. That's not really formal. A formal name, but generally they call it the circle group. This is specifically because it follows the complex unit circle essentially. So if you're on the complex plane, it's the a plus or minus bi, a plus bi. That's what complex form is. It's essentially the complex plane of the unit circle. That's essentially what it is. The U1 group is the group of all complex numbers with an absolute value of 1, meaning that it pertains to all complex numbers that exist within the unit circle in the complex plane. I didn't even see that I had that. I just kind of guessed it. The U1 group is specifically a group of 1-by-1 matrices of complex valued unitary matrices. As with many of these chapters, it is imperative that one at least knows what a matrix is, for non-abelian Lie groups pertain specifically to matrices. That's essentially, group theory is based almost entirely upon matrices. Like that's the whole part. That is a very important part of group theory. The next conservation law is the law of conservation of color charge. This one's a little different. Now, if you remember the episode on quantum chromodynamics, we got pretty far into color charge. It is a quantum number that specifically pertains to a quark's interactions with the gluon through the strong force. Now, this is a particularly... We remember that we established the next quantum number because we were finding these mesons, we were finding these baryons, these hadrons that had what appeared to be the same exact quarks in the volume, in the composite particle. And that doesn't make sense because quarks are fermions, which means that they are restricted to the Pauli exclusion principle, meaning that they cannot have the same quantum numbers as their counterparts, as the other quarks in the substance, in the volume, or in the composite particle. Now, we discovered color charge specifically because it would solve this problem, and it did. It did. QCD is a very important theory. But anyways, in a previous chapter, we discussed this. It was explained through the color charge. We explained quantum chromodynamics through the color charge. And the color charge is a specific quantum number specifically pertaining to quarks and gluons. It relates to the strong interaction between quarks and gluons in QCD. I already said that, but exactly. That's essentially what it is. Color charge conservation is an extremely complicated concept, so bear with me as I attempt to explain it. In physics, a field is defined as a physical quantity that has a value for each point in space and time. In color charge mechanics, there are color charge field lines, which depicts the strong force acting between color charges, or different quarks in a hadron. To envision this, imagine arcs occurring between the three colors, red, green, and blue, or color charges, in a baryon, such as the neutron. Color charge is conserved in the way that these fields are conserved. So, in the Wikipedia page that I used to find this, you'll find these... They're basically these field lines. You'll see them. They connect the quarks between one another, essentially. And basically, those field lines that exist, literally exist, they're strong interactive field lines, they exist and are conserved under the law of conservation of color charge. That's essentially what is going on. So it's not like, because the color technically... The color charge itself can change, but there has to be a color charge somewhere else that changes to that. Like, it's a very complicated topic, but color charge, like in a specific quark, it can change from what I've heard. So, like, according to an example portrayed in the article I was reading, link in bibliography, pertaining to color charge conservation, color charge conservation means that the ends of the color lines must be either in the initial or the final state, equivalently that no lines break in the middle of the diagram, referring to a diagram of color charge field lines. Additionally, color charge is conserved in the way that when a quark absorbs or emits a gluon, the quark's color must change in adherence to the gluon exchange. Furthermore, quark color amounts must be conserved in any system. So this is exactly what I was talking about. So imagine a gluon being exchanged from a red and a blue color charge quark. That's what I'm going to think. So if it's exchanged to the blue quark, maybe I would assume that the blue cork may turn red and the red cork may turn blue, because the color charge has to be conserved. The amount of it technically has to be conserved. That's exactly what they're referring to. But anyways, I would just suggest looking at the bibliography, going and looking at color charge conservation, because it is a very interesting topic. But anyways, the underlying symmetry between cork color charge and conservation is yet another Lie group gauge invariance, this time being the special unitary triplet, for all who know what the SU3 group is. A particular Lie group that is defined by a group of 3x3 matrices that have determinants of 1. As is already known, gauge invariance is a particular invariance that occurs when the Lagrangian is unaltered under local transformations by certain Lie groups. Through Noether's theorem, particular gauge invariances caused by different Lie groups create conservation laws. The special unitary triplet, or SU3 of course, the Lie group that through Noether's theorem defines color charge conservation, is an 8-dimensional special unitary group consisting of 3x3 unitary matrices. I know 3 times 3 equals 9, there's a reason for it. Again, with a determinant of 1. As can be seen, and as unfortunate as it may seem, the most advanced physics deals specifically within the bounds of abstract algebra. That is the underlying symmetry of color charge conservation. Weak isospin is a quantum number that relates specifically to the weak interaction, somewhat similar, not really, to color charge in the way that the number pertains to a fundamental interaction. It is also similar to isospin under the strong interaction. It's more similar to isospin under the strong interaction. Weak isospin is conserved through the weak isospin conservation law, which establishes that all weak interactions must conserve T to the power of 3, or the third component of weak isospin. Weak isospin is underlain by SU2, or a special unitary doublet gauge invariance. SU2 is obviously a group of 2x2 unitary matrices with a determinant of 1, because every special unitary group has a determinant of 1. And as we already know, through the laws of Noether's theorem, SU2 gauge symmetry must be associated with a subsequent conservation law, and of course, in this case, weak isospin. The last law of conservation that will be detailed in this specific episode, but not the last one that exists, certainly not the last one that exists, is the law of conservation of probability. It's also known as the probability probability current. It's a mathematical quantity that describes the flow of probability, essentially. Unfortunately, probability conservation does not exist under the very simple laws of probability, but rather exists under the probability current in quantum mechanics. Essentially, based upon the example given by the article I read pertaining to this, one can imagine the probability density, a function whose value at a particular point in a sample space can be interpreted as providing a probability that the value of a random variable would equal the values in the sample as a heterogeneous fluid, where the probability current is the rate of flow of the fluid. So you can imagine this probability density function as a fluid, as a just moving fluid. The movement of this fluid is characterized by the probability current, so the current of this fluid, essentially. Some examples of the conservation of the probability current include plane waves, which are physical quantities whose values are constant over any plane that is perpendicular to the quantity's directions. And in this situation, the probability current, and specifically the probability density function, is conserved in the object. The probability current is gauge invariant, again meaning that the Lagrangian is invariant under local transformations from specific Lie groups. This invariance is known as probability invariance, which through Noether's theorem creates a conservation law, or probability conservation. But anyways, before we get to the actual conclusion of this episode, I'd just like to say that I'm done with my AP test, I'm done with everything, basically my school year is completely over. So yeah, I will be able to resume longer episodes soon. This was one of the episodes I made while I had AP tests still going on, but I don't have AP tests going on anymore, thus I will be able to do this. I will be able to work with this in the future. I will be able to make longer episodes, get back to the 36-minute stuff, get back to the longer, more interesting and more complicated episodes. The next two episodes are going to be dealing with dark matter and dark energy, and then I think that the episode after that, 39, is going to be dealing specifically with abstract algebra. So that is going to be an interesting episode. I haven't taught myself abstract algebra yet, so I'm going to have to go back to that first. But yeah, so anyways, the various conservation laws quite literally run and define everything that exists in nature. As these are laws, of course, all new hypotheses must follow these to be adequate. I personally am very intrigued by these conservation laws, for they are laws that are learned in the most basic science classes, except they are learned only in minute detail. When one learns of the law of conservation of energy, they learn only that energy is conserved, but they learn nothing of Noether's theorem and the underlying symmetry that creates the conservation laws. Few know of the types of conservation laws, and even fewer know of the conservation laws in quantum theory. These conservation laws are fundamental to the existence of literally everything. Understanding these concepts means understanding the universe, at least in its very simplest and fundamental form. Anyway, thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. As I say every episode, please click the link in the description of my podcast and donate to the podcast. Again, I have 12 years of college ahead of me, so any donation, even a single cent, will further me toward my goals. Anyway, take care and stay curious.